Welcome to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staber. They pirouetted faster, jumped higher, practiced harder and longer just to break into the white world of ballet, to show that the classical art form, long denied to dancers of color, could be interpreted by anyone. Against the backdrop of the civil rights movement, a group of five young women became the swans of Harlem, dancing for kings, queens, and presidents. But their names had faded, disappearing from our collective memory until a new book brought them back to life. Journalist Karen Volby is the author of The Swans of Harlem, Five Black Ballerinas, 50 Years of Sisterhood, and the Reclaiming of a Groundbreaking History. Welcome to All Sides, Karen.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I'd like you to set the stage for us. What's happening in the world when Arthur Mitchell, a ballet dancer himself, decides to create the Dance Theater of Harlem?
Well, it's 1968, and Arthur Mitchell, who had been the first premier dancer at George Balanchine's New York City Ballet, he is an international superstar. He's traveling the globe, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is assassinated. And it really shocks him into his sense of purpose. And he realizes that he needs to go home to the neighborhood that raised him up, Harlem. And he needs to prove that he is not an exception on the classical stage, but that if given the opportunity, there is a whole world of Black classically trained dancers who deserve a chance in the spotlight. And so he decides to build the Dance Theater of Harlem.
And for all the strides made during the civil rights, ballet, out of all other forms of dance, seems to be the one that held on the tightest to its exclusionary beliefs.
Yep. For decades, a ballerina has sort of represented this feminine ideal and this very elite art form. And an art form that is also sort of seen as exclusionary, and for the creme de la creme, you know, it was born to entertain the royals in Europe. And because we are part of a broken culture, the Black body and temperament is seen as ill-suited for the classical stage. So that even if Black children were bold enough to be the only in a dance studio growing up, they were regularly denied auditions for ballet companies. And if by some fluke they managed to get in, they were very much relegated to the core because there was this belief that the Black body would break the color line.
Yeah, what I find fascinating is this is a time when West Side Story debuts. So we are seeing, you know, people of color in big productions, in lead roles. But when Black dancers get into Juilliard, they can't major in ballet.
Yep, regularly they're told, well, perhaps you'd be better suited for modern or contemporary. And Arthur Mitchell would always say, like, you know, you want me on flat feet. You think that I'm a primitive and that classical dancing doesn't belong to me and I can't understand it and I can't bring value to it. So you have this generations of ballerinas who are pushed away from the art form, even if it feels like this is my calling, this is my gift. I can make this art form more beautiful just by my presence on stage, and they're being denied it.
And so that's the backdrop in which the book Swans of Harlem unfolds. It's about five Black ballerinas and their barrier-breaking careers, but it's also, I think, a story about the power of female friendships. And family, mothers and daughters in particular. Can you tell us a little bit about the mothers of these five women?
Oh my gosh, with pleasure. So the women, it is these five friends who've known each other for half a century, and they came together and in company with one another, they helped build this company. It begins with Lydia Abarca, who grows up in the Harlem Projects, and she has a very practical mother who, when her 17-year-old daughter says, I'm going to quit my job at the bank, I'm going to forego my scholarship to Fordham, there's this Black man who says he can make me a star. her mother has to say, "Oh God, okay." There's Sheila Rohand, who's the youngest of eight in a West Indian enclave in Staten Island. She's raised by a single mother who's very practical, loves the Brooklyn Dodgers, not ballet, and has to say to her 27-year-old daughter, who is the mother of three young children, "Okay, go see who this Arthur Mitchell is." There's Gail McKinney Griffith, who has to call her mother when she says, "I'm dropping out of Juilliard. They won't let me be a ballet major. I'm going to go see what Dance Theater of Harlem is all about." And her mother has to say, "Okay." And then there's Carlia Shelton, who's in Denver, and her mother says, "My little girl wants to be a ballerina. There's no way she can make it happen in America, but I'm going to let her go her own road." And then there's amazing Marcia Sells, who, when she's in the Nutcracker as part of the Cincinnati Ballet as a child, her mother hears a girl in the audience say, "I've never seen a black snowflake before." And Marcia's mother turns around and says very elegantly, "You've also never seen Candy Dance."
I love
These
that
are.
moment. That moment made me like cackle in the book. It
Yes.
was such a witty comeback.
Such a witty comeback, not unkind, and getting to the essence of it's ballet, it's all fantasy. We're here to live in a snow globe. And those are the five women who raised these incredible five women.
And you're also a mother to two black dancers. What do you want them to take away from this book when they grow up and read it?
Yes, so I am the white adoptive mother of two black girls who are dancers themselves. I want them to take away the sense that even when they might find themselves the only in a room or in a dance studio or in a classroom or in a supermarket, that they are actually not alone. They do not have to be unicorns in this world to be great. There is a whole grand tradition that surrounds them, not just in dance, but in other spheres. And I want them to see their mother appreciating and acknowledging Black excellence.
We're going to be joined by two of the dancers in a few minutes. Marcia Sells, who was from Cincinnati, and Lydia Abarca, who was the first Black prima ballerina. But first, I want to spend a few minutes talking about their choreographer, Arthur Mitchell. He strikes me in the book as a brilliant but complicated man. He comes off as both a hero and a villain.
Oh, yes. The great Arthur Mitchell, who through his pure audacity, his charisma, his stubbornness, his egomania, manages to build something enduring and beautiful during the civil rights movement. He was a taskmaster. He could be a narcissist. Like I said, he was egomaniacal. But he also kept his promises to his dancers. They did shock the world. He did see the best in them. He did demand that they be ambassadors, not just of this art form, but of their race. That burden was heavy. He wanted them completely loyal to his mission. And sometimes that meant they had to sublimate parts of themselves. And I will say, our cultural heroes get to be flawed, including our Black male cultural heroes. And that in the course of the book, the women have variously dramatic exits from the company, not all of them happy or healthy. But there is reconciliation with Mr. Mitchell for each of them by the end. And that's sort of hard-earned, but it's incredibly meaningful that they have made peace with their mentor.
I think in some ways, I got the impression that Mitchell felt the weight of the world on his shoulders. You described him as ambassadors, proof that Black people could excel at anything, even the traditionally white art of ballet. And I want to play a clip of Mitchell from a 1973 documentary.
Five and six and seven and eight and one.
I remember I'd go to auditions and they'd say, "I'm very sorry, you're a marvelous dancer, but you're Black. We can't give you a job." And I couldn't understand. I mean, I could understand it intellectually. In the sense, they would say, "Well, you know, I have to have a line and a look and da, da, da." I said, "But I can dance. I can do it better than the other person." as what does the color of my skin have to do with whether I can do the turns or the jumps? There's still a group of people who feel that blacks cannot do classical ballet.
And I think, you know, I don't want to excuse some of his behavior because it was hard to read in certain places. And I don't, you know, I don't want to spoil the book because people should absolutely go pick it up. But I think he felt like Atlas almost holding the world on his shoulders.
Mm-hmm. He did the impossible. And even just, that's so cool that you just played that clip, because even just hearing his voice, I never met him, but just the charisma, the zeal of his voice makes me want to sit up straighter. Like he's the most persuasive, charismatic person in the world. It's funny, his first pianist who became a conductor, who is now a Pulitzer Prize winner, Tanya Leon, told me Arthur Mitchell built a stage for himself and then he had to stay on it. I think when you're a groundbreaker, you are always in some ways performing. You are always representing. And that task is heavy on a human, I think, and can probably bring out our flaws. It did his.
Yeah, he said once in an interview that he laughed when people would get excited about their dancers, like as though, quote, a black girl in toe shoes is from outer space. Or that crowds came expecting, quote, super fly and switchblades, because after all, it is Harlem. Mm-hmm. And he had this belief that there were always black classical dancers. They just never got on stage.
Right.
And I find it to be so fascinating. Like one of the saddest parts of the book, I think, is in the lead up to the creation of this company. You talk about all these ballet dancers who made it into other companies, even as these side role background characters. But in a lot of times, they couldn't perform in the mm-hmm. South.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Raven Wilkinson is touring with the Ballet Russe, and she's not allowed to stay in the same hotel as the rest of the company. Or there would be performances where she was told during rehearsal, it is not safe for you to perform, and they'd send her back to her hotel, and she could see through her window the Ku Klux Klan's cross burning. Imagine being so committed and in love with your art form that you're willing to risk harm like that, indignity like that. It's astonishing.
So we're going to talk with two of the ballerinas from the Swans of Harlem. So I don't want to give away their stories ahead of time, but I do want to spend a little time talking about Sheila Rohan, because what I find particularly fascinating about her is she was married and a mother of three, and she's 27 at the time, and she lies to Arthur Mitchell and says she's 20 just to get into the company.
Three young children at home, 27. It is unheard of for a ballerina to have that biography as she starts her career. And yes, the courage to show up and to sort of leave those facts out. And then when her kids would sort of join her on Saturdays at the studio, she had them sort of play a little, quote, game where they would call her Aunt Sheila. And I will say her husband supported her dreams in the 60s, said, we will make it work. We have lots of family that can help with the kids. You're an artist. Go do what you do. And also Arthur Mitchell, let it be said that when she finally told him after a year, I do have three kids, I have to keep this in mind as our touring schedule heats up, he was annoyed. And not because she was older, because she was a mother. He was annoyed because he said, if you had told me, I would have paid you some more money. And sure enough, her next paycheck, there was a little bump in it. So Arthur Mitchell respected her hustle.
How are you able to find these women? Because I know they came together, and we're definitely going to talk about that in a few minutes. So I know we're going to hear how they found each other. How did you find them?
Looking back, it feels like magic. But Marcia, who will be joining the conversation, lives on the same Harlem block as a literary agent who knows me and who knows my
girl. Goodness.
And who knows, you know, I would post photos of my daughters. They dance at a Black dance studio, and I'd post photos of pancaking their shoes to match the color of their skin, not knowing that it was these women who started the tradition at Dance Theater of Harlem. And Barbara Jones just said, what if you took a meeting? Marsha's doing this incredible thing with her friends, and they're reclaiming their history, and maybe there's something beautiful here. And I took a meeting, and the women immediately started pouring out their gorgeous stories. And I said, maybe I'm not the right person for this as a white woman. And we just kind of liked each other. And we took a second meeting and a third meeting. And it takes a long time to build trust. But man, I felt honored to be in the presence of these women. And they just were generous with their stories. And now I consider them like family.
That's Karen Valby, author of The Swans of Harlem, Five Black Ballerinas, 50 Years of Sisterhood, and Their Reclaiming of a Groundbreaking History. Coming up, Marsha and Lydia, two of the five Black ballerinas, share their own stories with us. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Many people think Misty Copeland was America's first Black ballerina. She was the first Black principal dancer with the prestigious American Ballet Theater. But a generation before Misty took the stage, five women danced for kings, queens, and presidents, the Swans of Harlem. Their lives and years at the Dance Theater of Harlem are chronicled in a new book called The Swans of Harlem, Five Black Ballerinas, 50 Years of Sisterhood, and Their Reclaiming of a Groundbreaking History. Author Karen Valby is still with us. And joining us now are two of those five dancers, Lydia Abarca Mitchell, a founding member of the company who danced lead roles in Agon, Swan Lake, and more. Welcome to All Sides, Lydia.
Hello. Hi, everyone.
Hi. And Marsha Sells, who grew up here in Cincinnati and performed with the Cincinnati Ballet before joining the Dance Theater of Harlem. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Lydia, when we meet you in the book, you've kind of given up on ballet and you're about to go to college. What changes your mind?
I had studied, I had a good training at Juilliard and Harkness, and it was difficult because I didn't really know what I was working towards. So that's why I quit. And I had a normal junior and senior year in high school. But when I graduated, one of my sisters was taking violin at the Harlem School of the Arts. And she said there was a Black man who was going to be teaching ballet. Well, at the time I said, well, I've never had a Black ballet teacher. Maybe he could make ballet more relatable to me. And it turned out to be Arthur Mitchell, and he was starting a ballet company. So yeah, my whole life changed right then and there.
I love the anecdote in the story that he looks at your feet and immediately is like, I want you in my company. And I think that's such a poignant moment, because in the book, we also learned that in the white world of ballet, there was this false belief that the feet of Black people were too flat for ballet. So I find it so intentionally poignant that he takes one look at you and the shape of you and is like, you are a ballerina.
I had really good training. I just didn't know what to do with it. And I was very proud of my arches and my feet. And I had some point classes at Harkness and Juilliard. So it was a match made in heaven.
Marsha, you joined the company a little later. Can you describe for us what it was like to see the Dance Theater of Harlem, come and give a performance in your hometown?
So imagine you're 9 years old. I had been studying ballet at that point since I was four and was the only Black kid in a person, period, in my ballet. I was going to say class, but even I didn't see Black people in the company either at that time, or the Cincinnati Civic Ballet at that moment. And then comes 69, 70, and Dance Theater of Harlem is coming to Cincinnati, Ohio. They perform at that point, the College Conservatory of Music is joined with, you know, at CCM at the University of Cincinnati, and they perform in the corporate theater. And to see a whole company, to see Lydia, I got to see Lydia. I got to see Virginia. I got to see Gail, McKinney Griffith, who is also, you know, one of our swans, although it's passed away. I got to see Sheila Rohan and Homer Bryant and other dancers, both, you know, men and women, women in pointe shoes. So I could imagine, okay, this is, and I love ballet. So I was, you know, I think even my mother and father were probably wondering what's going to really happen with this. So Dance Theater of Harlem, seeing it, seeing these dancers says, okay, this is possible. I could actually see myself in a career.
And although Lydia was raised in New York City, you move there as a teenager and you have to like go to high school and go to these classes. It's going to be a huge life transition.
It was. I mean, for Cincinnatians who know Walnut Hills, to leave Walnut Hills High School, really major high school, and also for a family, my parents were not performers. They weren't, you know, the idea of me pursuing a quote profession in dance, even though I consider them, you know, they were very generous. I'm sure they were not absolutely concerned as to what was going to happen next. I will say the happen next is that Dance Theater of Harlem says, we have a high school for you to go to. I go to the professional children's school. It's a private school. So Dance Theater of Harlem essentially is part of my scholarship. And when I'm coming up, they pay for my tuition. And it's a wonderful high school. So it covered those bases for my family. And I had a family. There was a young woman who had been at the University of Cincinnati, a woman named Debbie Bernardo, whose uncle lived in Brooklyn and had a townhouse, which is a
Brooklyn is a huge, for anyone who's ever been to New York City, it's another planet compared to like Harlem. Like,
well,
you had to navigate all that.
Yes, definitely. And in 1976, yes, I learned the D train first to get to 60th Street and to PCS. And then, you know, spoiler alert, the D train and the A train go express from 59th Street to 125th and then to 145th, which made it possible for me to actually make it to company class on time when leaving school. But yeah, I had to navigate that. I mean, I'm, you know, Midwest, your parents drive you or you're in a carpool or you take the school bus. And I remember the first time when I was taken to the school and signed up and I said, you know, what happens when, like, if I get sick or will you write the note? Wait a minute, me? I write the thing note. It's like, well, and they were used to kids who were essentially pursuing their professions and not having family immediately around. It was a wonderful family I was with, and so it worked out.
Lydia, when some of the younger dancers start to come in as this group is getting established, you know, what did you see your role? I know there's been conversation that Gail was kind of the mother of the group, but, you know, where did you think, like, what responsibility did you think you had as an older, more experienced dancer?
Just to help them learn by example. Arthur Mitchell had us working very, very hard, and it was essential that they found out in the very beginning that you cannot sit during watching rehearsals, everybody's up learning. He did not believe in osmosis to learn roles. And we did. We took the younger, newer dancers under our wings and just let them know, you know, what was allowed and what was not allowed. And it became a family very, very quickly.
And it seems like navigating Arthur Mitchell's personality, because you describe these long, tiring rehearsals that can be punishing and sometimes nonstop, very, very, I don't know if cruel is the right word for his criticism, but one of the things that I found most moving, though, was despite those difficult circumstances, like physically demanding, mentally demanding, is that you get a real sense of like the friendships that were so sustaining during that time.
We all wanted to be there. We wanted to succeed. We were on a mission to prove that Blacks could do ballet, even though we knew we could do it, but we had to be able to show that we were a sophisticated, talented, well-oriented ballet company. And it was just awesome. What can I say?
And Anna, it's funny, in when we were bringing the book around, it felt like people really wanted to hear about, ooh, the competitiveness and like how cutthroat was it. And I think the thing that is forgotten is, if you have a company of people who have sort of been told they couldn't or told they shouldn't, that
or isolated
or isolated, community matters. And so the friendships, the familial environment, it was them against the world. And that's different, I would think, than the average ballet company.
And Lydia also pointed out, it was also, it was a family, but in a literal sense, we created a family. We had, when I came into the company, I had dancers who were considered my parents, and they were Ronald Perry and Stephanie Dabney were my two parents, and they would introduce me to the company. They helped me understand what are the rules, and the idea of having both a male and a female, even in, as we think about it now in terms of gender terms, but it's different dancing. So you had somebody who could give you that perspective, in addition to seeing, as Lydia said, seeing the senior dancers performing, telling you, you know, as she said, can't sit during rehearsals, what you needed to do to learn roles, to advance yourself. So that was a key part at the very beginning of the founding of Dance Theater Parliament. And as Karen said, it is different when you're gathering all these people from different places. For those of us who came from learning ballet, where we're the only, and then to be in a group and a collective group to actually do this amazing work, which we've been training for, and to know that somebody believes in you to do this work, it's a very different atmosphere than a lot of other companies.
But you didn't escape, I think, or at least I got the impression, some of the rules or restrictions that come along for just any ballerina. You know, Arthur Mitchell also fixated on your weight, on your shape, on how you styled your hair. And, you know, I think ballet companies generally have long struggled with disordered eating and ideas around what shape a ballet dancer should have. That has to be so, so difficult.
I mean, it is. It was. I mean, the one thing I have to say, I will think back, I don't know if you have seen The Red Shoes, but there's an amazing moment in The Red Shoes where the lead ballerina is not the sort of twiggy version that New York City Ballet and ABT and other companies would portray. It was more of a fulsome person. But there was something about the idea of line and shape and what it looked like that definitely permeated. And it's beginning to change now, but definitely permeated the ballet in the 20th century. The last half of the 20th century was just very challenging. And then all the other things in terms of quote unquote Black body types. But I mean, if you saw Lydia and I, we're two different body types. I mean, we're like everybody, you know, else. So people generalizing that, oh my God, Black ballet dancers are going to either have bigger hips or, you know, their rear ends are going to be bigger and not, and, you know, interrupt the line. All of that was just hogwash. And when you see all of the dancers in Dance Theater Parliament, and as we say, the full array of colors and the full array of shapes and sizes, you know, even with Mr. Mitchell and all of his challenges, you know that he was really pushing something that was a little bit different than what New York City Ballet was trying to push. And that's what we as dancers had to many times absorb and nurture ourselves or take care of ourselves when we were faced with those challenges about weight.
I was fortunate. I was always skinny. My two kneecaps looked at each other, you know, growing up. But Arthur worked with everybody. He pulled out the best of each dancer, regardless of, you know, if their feet needed a little more work. I mean, that's in any ballet company. So again, there comes that family connection. We supported each other, you know, let me stretch your feet for you every morning, or let me help you stretch your legs to the side. He was just working to bring out the best.
Karen, I also, one of the things I found so fascinating about reading the book as somebody who, you know, the last time I put on ballet shoes was like as a 6-year-old toddling around in a studio. Yeah. But one of the things I found fascinating was this idea that if you've seen one ballet company dance Swan Lake, you've seen one ballet company dance Swan Lake, and that every dancer has their own style, their own twist. And while it can be the same moves, it doesn't have the same feel. And I got the impression that Arthur Mitchell like leaned into the shapes, the colors of his dancers, and sometimes built choreography around that to sort of emphasize their unique features and movements.
Oh, for sure. Lydia, will you share about the DTH tip?
The walk. Yeah. I mean, not the little bouncy, I'm walking over here to stage right or stage left. We had a swag to it. It's just a pride that came across in our dancing. And I want to bring up a point about Swan Lake. I had never seen a ballet when I started with Dance Theater of Harlem. I had just trained. But having that visual connection with what I was working towards would have been so valuable to me. So even when we attacked doing the classics finally, it was our own. I didn't have any previous preconceived ideas of what it should be or what it should look like. I just felt what I should do.
What was it like, though, to step out on stage in like a lead role in Swan Lake, such a traditional, like iconic ballet?
Yeah, I mean, it could be intimidating. The curtain was getting ready to go up. I had George Balanchine there. He wanted the pace to be a little bit more sprightly. Freddie Franklin wanted this soft and melty Swan, and Arthur Mitchell, you know, he's very dynamic. Like, I want to see a zai in there somewhere. So kind of like when the curtain went up, I wasn't quite clear about what kind of swan was going to come out of Lydia. But yeah, it was fantastic to know that people wanted to see if it could be done. And yes, it could be done.
We'll talk about how did the audience respond, Lydia, that first night?
Oh, when you come out and just stand there, you know, before your first PK arabesque, it was, you know, but I had a job to do. It wasn't enough to just sit on the applause. I had a job to do, just like every single dancer in that company had a job to do. And we did it.
But also, I mean, when Lydia says Mr. Mitchell would say the za, I mean, one of the things that we all talk about, I mean, with the swans when we were talking with Karen and talking about the book is that even the way our classes were, you know, yes, we had classical ballet classes, but the kinds of things and the attack that either Mr. Mitchell or Carl Shook or any one of our teachers wanted us to have, was so different than what I experienced when I was in Cincinnati or experienced in any other dance class in New York City, even though we weren't supposed to be taking classes at other places. Spoiler alert, we did. But we were quite distinctive. And I will say there are times when people it was an energy that not all ballet companies at that time were expressing. I mean, it was a real excitement, and I mean, Carlia says this, we love dancing with each other. So it
Exactly.
was always and cheering each other on and exciting. And that energy, it wasn't just about performing for the audience. Sometimes we were performing for ourselves, which was, I think, a kind of energy that made Dance Theater of Harlem just so exciting. And that's what's been fun when we get together and we talk about this, and you hear some of this or read some of this in the book, how we recognize now, reflecting on what it was like before, how we were so different and still and so excellent. I mean, that whole notion of these words now, I guess I can still say diversity, though the idea that diversity doesn't mean it's not excellent. I mean, that baseball is
Yes.
not excellent until Jackie Robinson joins. Inclusive excellence is what Dance Theater of Harlem brings.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well said.
Yeah, I think that feels like a good moment to take a break and say that coming up, we're going to talk about our third act, how the Swans of Harlem reconnected during COVID and reclaimed their place in history. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour with journalist Karen Volpe about the author of a new book, The Swans of Harlem: Five Black Ballerinas, 50 Years of Sisterhood, and Their Reclaiming of a Groundbreaking History. With us also are two of the Swans, the former ballerinas of the Dance Theater of Harlem, Lydia Abarca Mitchell and Marcia Sells. Karen, you write in the book, quote, "They had all been knocked off balance by the anointing of Misty Copeland, by what they felt like a deliberate scrubbing of their groundbreaking history." And it's fascinating to me that that moment is such it, because like I remember that, right? Like I remember all the articles and all the coverage of her as the first black ballerina.
Gosh, not only do I remember it, I embraced it because I had these girls who are dancers in my home, and so we got the Misty Copeland doll and we got the books and I was so glad to get them, but I did think, well, thank God, finally. And I was as ignorant as so many others that Misty stood on the shoulders of these women. We got this amazing New York Times review where the woman writes that recognition delayed is recognition denied. I think somebody like Lydia Abarca, who is the world's first prima ballerina, who is the first ballerina with a company to be on, the first black ballerina with a ballet company to be on the cover of Dance Magazine in 1975, who is the it girl of the 60s and 70s, to then be told decades later, essentially, it never happened. That type of gaslighting is really hard on a soul. And I also think it's hard on somebody like Misty Copeland, who in the book shares that she'd never heard of Lydia Abarca's name until I published a story in the New York Times in 2021 about the Swans. That robs her also of the power of example. So part of the job of the women coming together to remind a careless culture of what they had done The hope is that that heals their spirits and that they can more comfortably rest on their laurels and own the fact of their greatness. I remember one of the most poignant things that the women said to me when I first started meeting them. Lydia started crying in a Zoom meeting with the women, saying, "When I'm with you all, I remember how I used to feel back then. I used to feel important." And Carlia Shelton, who says to the women, "Was it real? Was I really a principal ballerina?" So what these women have done is not just remind the world of history, but they've reaffirmed to each other, yes, it really happened, because we were there too. We know that it happened.
Karen, that's so beautiful the way you put that. You know, Arthur Mitchell was the face and the voice of Dance Theater of Harlem, and we were quite happy to be part of this machine that was going to work. But, you know, when the curtain went up, when you look back at it now, it wasn't him on the stage, it was us. And so I know one of my catalysts was my daughter trying to brag to some friends that her mother was the first prima, and she's looking on the internet and there's nothing but Misty Copeland. And we didn't have internet back in the 70s. We didn't have social media. We didn't have phones. We didn't have phones, you know? So it was very hard to carry those stories forward. But it's our time. During the pandemic, we saw each other throughout. You know, once everybody left for whatever reasons, it was their time to leave, but we kept in touch. That kind of sisterhood does not go away. We loved each other. We worked together. And so when we started these Zoom calls during the pandemic, all these stories were coming out, and all the laughter and the tears and the, oh, what, can you believe what we did? And, you know, push come to shove, we met Karen, the article came out in New York Times, and now the book. The book, we did lose one of the swans last October, Gail McKinney Griffith, but her story is in the book that will never go away.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a little bit about Gail, because I just saw, like, just recently, the New York Times wrote an obituary for her. And, you know, it's a big deal to get a New York Times obituary. Not everybody who passes away gets one. And what I found fascinating was that she passed in October of 2023, but this obituary happened just this month.
And it happened. New York Times. It's not the New York Times fault. I want to jump in here because Gail's passing was traumatic for the family. And so pulling together, you know, what was necessary to do that, that article was a challenge. And I do think, what the Times also realizes as we're coming out with the book, because they're aware of it, that it was time to put out this obituary. And they really, in working with finally being able to connect with family and pull that together, as well as with Dance Theater of Harlem. But this is one time where it was not just a moment. I mean, when somebody passes, you know, it's so traumatic, and thinking about where to send the information about obituary is not always the first top of mind. But the beauty of it, just as Lydia said, the fact that both the story about her passing and the book are all coming out at the same time, you know, maybe that was what was meant to be. I mean, it has been kismet.
You all are sure Googleable now, like you're all over the internet.
My husband is so excited. He goes, "When you put in Swans of Harlem, your book comes up for us." Like, so,
and your photographs.
It's a wonderful gift.
Yeah, the book itself has some beautiful photographs of all of you. But yeah, the photographs are now all over the internet too. So Lydia, your daughter, can easily Google search and share with her
Definitely.
Friends.
Definitely.
But you know what is a shame, and is that there's not a lot of footage of them dancing. And that is a tragedy, either because, you know, VHS tapes
degrade,
or in the chaos of administration and trying to keep an institution like DTH alive, archives aren't properly managed. there's just not a lot of footage. And so something that's been very beautiful, we've been on book tour, and to have people in a Chicago audience stand up and say, "Lydia, I saw you dance as a child and it was magical." Or, "Lydia, you were my teacher once at Dance Theater of Harlem, and I was so enchanted by you that I'd said, if I ever have a baby girl, I'm going to name them Lydia." Like,
So there were
I
people all over the
don't
country who still remembered you.
know.
Wow.
And it floored us. We didn't know that. I mean, I will say the beauty of the book and this opportunity to both talk about it and all these conversations, as well as to go out to the different places we've been going to see audience members. We had also somebody in Atlanta talk about that they had come to Dance Theater Harlem in the 70s, and they'd actually seen Miss Wynn's workshop, the Zelda Wynn, who made all the costumes and designed them for Dance Theater Harlem, in the very beginning. I mean, those are, I mean, it's just, it's wonderful. It's wonderful.
Yeah, and what I, Marsha, I want to ask you a question because you've had quite an impressive second career. You becoming the dean of students at Columbia and Harvard School of Law. You became the Metropolitan Opera's first ever chief diversity officer, but you never revealed your dance history on your resume until way, way, way late in the game. Like, were people just sort of stunned that you had been a ballerina?
Yes. In the Washington D.C., I realized it in Washington D.C., where we were at Poets and Prose, a number of my classmates, I'm about to celebrate 40 years since I graduated law school. So a number of classmates came and they're like, "We never knew. We never knew." And it wasn't, I will admit, and this is a sad statement in terms of the arts, I thought that I wouldn't be considered serious if I said that I was a dancer. Now I know that that was probably the most silly thing I could have done, because given what I had to do to memorize ballets, what I had to do to learn how to work with other people, what I had to do just to train my body to do this, I know now was probably the best preparation for being one, going to law school, but also becoming a lawyer. Particularly for what I did when I first came out of law school, when I tried rape and child abuse cases, to be able to stand in front of a jury and be comfortable with the gaze of people and still put a sentence together, is it, even though in ballet you don't speak, but I probably should have done it earlier. But it's, I still think sometimes we wonder whether it was real. Because it seems like such a fantasy. So to walk up and say, "Yeah, I was a ballerina," it just wasn't the first thing I would think of.
Yeah, but Marsha, the things that we took away from Dance Theater of Harlem, the work ethic, the discipline, the endurance, all of those qualities, and the companionship, the sisterhood, all of those things have been useful throughout our lives. Those will never go away.
And it sounds like neither will the Legacy Council and your regular
No.
meetings.
No.
I love that because so
Wow.
many people reconnected during COVID. I think that's such like I love that this was this story, this book is really born out of that pandemic. It seems like
It was a
Absolutely.
time to remember what is important in life, and what these women did was important, and the beauty they made together is eternal, as is their sisterhood, and even as they're missing Gail McKinney Griffith, they are holding up and celebrating her legacy.
Completely. I mean, something too about the, sadly, the pandemic, it just as Karen was saying, it did make you sort of have this conversation about what is important, but it also made you think about what am I leaving behind? So that was, I think, that's why it, as you said, it's not going to go away.
And there's a new generation coming up. We want them to know. We want them to build on what we already started.
Yeah, and so the book, The Swans of Harlem, Five Black Ballerinas, 50 Years of Sisterhood, and Their Reclaiming of a Groundbreaking History is out now, and I highly recommend it. It made both me and my producer cry at times. So always the sign of a good piece of work. I want to say thank you to the book's author, Karen Valby. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you to Lydia Abarca Mitchell. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And to Ohio's own Marcia Sells. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'm on my way to Cincinnati right now.
And that will do it for this hour of All Sides on 89.7. NPR News.
Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News is Central Ohio's most comprehensive source for news from anywhere around the world.
Iran backs Hamas in its fight against Israel.
Across the nation.
A federal case against book restrictions in Florida schools is going forward.
In our community.
Columbus City Council expands from 7 members to 9.
Listen to the difference. 89.7 NPR News. Global. Local.
Support for WOSU comes from Schottenstein Roofing, a family-owned company with an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau. Committed to excellence and dedicated to community, supporting youth athletics and trusted news stations like WOSU. More at schottensteinroofing.com.
This is WOSU-FM and HD1 Columbus, 89.7 NPR News. Global. Local.
When I first arrived in Egypt, my eyes hurt because of how much lighting there is at night. That's something that we didn't see for 7 months.
Some Palestinians have been able to flee Gaza, but millions are still there as the Israeli military moves on Rafah, and there's still no agreement to pause the war.
The Israeli invasion to Rafah and control Rafah crossing is making the situation worse and worse.
We are now left without any hospitals, schools. We have nothing. We don't have access to clean water. We don't have access to the internet or electricity. What kind of future would I have here? Not for me, it's for my 4 children.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today on Point, Palestinian civilians daily fight for survival. Stay with us.